This storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are face prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate fun. Daisy is just the ultimate fun.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You cause confusion and
6 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive. Bit grey today.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another Deepest Lore. Sorry I'm a bit late today. Something a little bit different today, which is that I found out about a book that George Orwell wrote during World War II. It's more like a pamphlet than a book, really. It was commissioned by the Ministry of Information, so he was basically working for the government. He later disowned the work and thought it was silly and a work of kind of propaganda. But what interests me is that Orwell never allowed this book to be republished. It does not appear in any of his books of collected essays that have been published since his death. I thought I had every Orwell essay in existence. And just today I discovered the existence of this, and naturally, given its subject matter, I thought it'd be interesting. So I don't know what it says. I know that Orwell disowned it, but I thought it'd be interesting to read through a portion of it on today's stream. Just before we get going, I'll remind people, do buy my courses. You've got a couple of days left for the 25% off Indian summer sale. Promo code MATE, that's MATE with three A's, and Dubai Populist Delusion and Prophets of Doom, the two books that, you know, if you've got Populist Delusion, buy Prophets of Doom. If you don't have either of them, buy them both. Okay, so without further ado, let us get going. Let me just make this screen bigger. The only copy I've been able to find anywhere that isn't like 300 quid to buy, it hasn't been republished since 1947, is on the Internet Archive. You can see I've borrowed it. And because I know people on the internet are stupid and, you know, that some scamp might think it was funny to sneak in there and, you know, borrow it before I could renew it. You know, I am pre-recording this so as to head off such tomfoolery and scampery at the pass. So that had you can't out troll a troller. Okay, so let us get started. England at first glance. In peacetime, it is unusual for foreign visitors to this country to notice the existence of the English people. Even the accent referred to by Americans as the English accent is not in fact common to more than a quarter of the population. In cartoons, in continental papers, England is personified by an aristocrat with a monocle, a sinister capitalist in a top hat, or a spinster in a Burberry. Hostile or friendly, nearly all generalizations that are made about England base themselves on the property-owning class and ignore the other 45 million. But the chances of war brought to England, either as soldiers or as refugees, hundreds of thousands of foreigners who would not normally have come here and forced them into intimate contact with ordinary people. Czechs, Poles, Germans and Frenchmen, to whom England meant Piccadilly and the Derby, found themselves quartered in sleepy East Anglian villages, in northern mining towns, or in the vast working-class areas of London, whose names the world had never heard until they were blitzed. Those of whom who had the gift of observation, those of whom who had the gift of observation will have seen for themselves that the real England is not the England of the guidebooks. Blackpool is more typical than Ascot. The top hat is a moth-eaten rarity. The language of the BBC is barely intelligible to the masses. Even the prevailing physical type does not agree with the caricatures, for the tall, lanky physique, which is traditionally English, is almost confined to the upper classes. The working classes, as a rule, are rather small, with short limbs and brisk movements, and with a tendency among the women to grow dumpy in early middle life. It is worth trying for a moment to put oneself in the position of a foreign observer, new to England, but unprejudiced, and able to, because of his work, to keep in touch with the ordinary, useful, unspectacular people. Some of his generalizations would be wrong, because he would not make enough allowance for the temporary dislocations resulting from war. Never having seen England in normal times, he might underrate the power of class distinctions, or think English agriculture healthier than it is, or be too impressed by the dinginess of the London streets or the prevalence of drunkenness. But with his fresh eyes, he would see a great deal that a native observer misses, and his probable impressions are worth tabulating. Almost certainly he would find the salient characteristics of the English common people to be artistic insensibility, gentleness, respect for legality, suspicion of foreigners, sentimentality about animals, hypocrisy, exaggerated class distinctions, and an obsession with sport. As for our artistic sensibility, ever-growing stretches of beautiful countryside are ruined by planless building. The heavy industries are allowed to convert whole counties into blackened deserts. Ancient monuments are wantonly pulled down or swamped by seas of yellow brick. Attractive vistas are blocked by hideous statues to non-entities. And all this without any popular protest whatever. When England's housing problem is discussed, its aesthetic aspect simply does not enter the mind of the average man, nor is there any widespread interest in any of the arts, except perhaps music. Poetry, the art in which, above all others, England has excelled, has, for more than a century, had no appeal whatever for the common people. It is only acceptable when, as in some popular songs and mnemonic rhymes, it is masquerading as something else. Indeed, the very word poetry arouses either derision or embarrassment in 98 people out of 100. Our imaginary foreign observer would certainly be struck by our gentleness, by the orderly behaviour of English crowds, the lack of pushing and quarrelling, the willingness to form queues, the good temper of harassed, overworked people like bus conductors. The manners of the English working class are not always very graceful, but they are extremely considerate. Great care is taken in showing a stranger the way. Blind people can travel across London with a certainty that they will be helped on and off every bus and across every street. In wartime, a few of the policemen carried revolvers, but England has nothing corresponding to the gendarmerie, the semi-military police living in barracks with unarmed rifles, sometimes even with tanks and aeroplanes, who are guardians of society, all the way from Calais to Tokyo. And except for certain well-defined areas in half a dozen big towns, there is very little crime or violence. The average of honesty is lower in the big towns than in the country. But even in London, the news vendor can safely leave his pile of pennies on the pavement while he goes for a drink. The prevailing gentleness of manners is a recent thing, however. Well within living memory, it was impossible for a smartly dressed person to walk down Ratcliffe Highway without being assaulted, and an eminent jurist asked to name a typically English crime could answer, kicking your wife to death. There is no revolutionary tradition in England, and even in extremist political parties, it is only the middle class membership that thinks in revolutionary terms. The masses still more or less assume that against the law is a synonym for wrong. It is known that the criminal law is harsh and full of anomalies, and that litigation is so expensive as always to favour the rich against the poor. But there is a general feeling that the law, such as it is, will be scrupulously administered, that a judge or magistrate cannot be bribed, and that no one will be punished without a trial. An Englishman does not believe in his bones, as a Spanish or Italian peasant does, that the law is simply a racket. It is precisely this general confidence in the law that has allowed a good deal of recent tampering with habeas corpus to escape public notice. But it is also causes some ugly situations to end peacefully. During the worst of the London Blitz, the authorities tried to prevent the public from using the tube stations as shelters. The people did not reply by storming the gates. They simply brought themselves penny, halfpenny tickets. They thus had legal status as passengers, and there was no thought of turning them out again. The traditional English xenophobia is stronger among the working class than the middle class. It was partly the resistance of the trade unions that prevented a really large influx of refugees from the fascist countries before the war. And when the German refugees were interned in 1940, it was not the working class that protested. The difference in habits, and especially in food and language, makes it very hard for English working people to get on with foreigners. Their diet differs a great deal from that of any European nation, and they are extremely conservative about it. As a rule, they will refuse even to sample a foreign dish. They regard such things as garlic and olive oil with disgust. Life is unlivable to them unless they have tea and puddings. And the peculiarities of the English language make it almost impossible for anyone who has left school at 14 to learn a foreign language after he has grown up. In the French Foreign Legion, for instance, the British and American legionnaires seldom rise out of the ranks because they cannot learn French, whereas a German learns French in a few months. English working people, as a rule, think it effeminate even to pronounce a foreign word correctly. This is bound up with... Sorry, that made me laugh. It only made me laugh because I'm so bad at pronouncing foreign words myself. But anyway, this is bound up with the fact that the upper classes learn foreign languages as a regular part of their education. Travelling abroad, speaking foreign tongues, enjoying foreign food are vaguely felt to be upper class habits, a species of snobbery, so that xenophobia is reinforced by class jealousy. Perhaps the most horrible spectacles in England are the dog cemeteries in Kensington Gardens at Stoke Poges. It actually adjoins the churchyard where Gray wrote his famous elegy, and at various other places. But there are also animals, ARP centres with miniature stretchers for cats, and in the first year of the war, there was the spectacle of Animal Day being celebrated with all its usual pomp in the middle of the Dunkirk evacuation. Although its worst follies are committed by upper-class women, the animal cult runs right through the nation and is probably bound up with the decay of agriculture and a dwindled birth rate. Several years of stringent rationing have failed to reduce the dog and cat population, and even in poor quarters of big towns, the bird fancier shops display canary seed at prices ranging up to 25 shillings a pint. Hypocrisy is so generally accepted as part of the English character that a foreign observer would be prepared to meet with it at every turn. But he would find extremely ripe examples in the laws dealing with gambling, drinking, prostitution, and profanity. He would find it difficult to reconcile the anti-imperialistic sentiments which are commonly expressed in England with the size of the British Empire. If he were a continental European, he would notice with ironical amusement that the English think it wicked to have a big army, but see nothing wrong with having a big navy. This, too, he would set down as hypocrisy, not altogether fairly, for it is the fact of being an island and therefore not needing a big army that has allowed British democratic institutions to grow up, and the mass of people are fairly well aware of this. Exaggerated class distinctions have been diminishing over a period of about 30 years, and the war has probably speeded up this process. But newcomers to England are still astonished and sometimes horrified by the blatant differences between class and class. The great majority of the people can still be placed in an instant by their manners, clothes, and general appearance. even the physical type differs considerably, the upper classes being on average several inches taller than the working class. But the most striking difference of all is in the language and accent. The English working class, as Mr. Wyndham Lewis has put it, are branded on the tongue. And though class distinctions do not exactly coincide with economic distinctions, the contrast between wealth and poverty is very much more glaring and more taken for granted than in most countries. The English were the inventors of several of the world's most popular games and have spread them more widely than any other product of their culture. The word football is mispronounced by scores of millions who have never heard of Shakespeare or Magna Carta. The English themselves are not astoundingly good at all games, but enjoy playing them. And to an extent that strikes foreigners as childish, they enjoy reading about them and betting on them. During the between war years, the football pools did more than any other one thing to make life bearable for the unemployed. Professional footballers, boxers, jockeys, and even cricketers enjoy a popularity that no scientist or artist could hope to rival. Nevertheless, sport worship is not carried to quite such imbecile lengths as one would imagine from reading the popular press. When the brilliant lightweight boxer Kid Lewis stood for Parliament in his native borough, he only scored 125 votes. These traits that we have enumerated are probably the ones that would strike an intelligent foreign observer first. Out of them, he might feel that he could construct a reliable picture of the English character. But then, probably, a thought would strike him. Is there such a thing as the English character? Can one really talk about nations as though they were individuals? And supposing one can, is there any genuine continuity between the England of today and the England of the past? As he wandered through the London streets, he would notice the old prints in the bookshop windows, and it would occur to him that if these things are representative, then England must have changed a great deal. It is not much more than 100 years since a distinguishing mark of English life was brutality. The common people, to judge by the prints, spent their time in an almost unending round of fighting, whoring, drunkenness, and bull baiting. Moreover, even the physical type appears to have changed. Where are they gone? The hulking draymen, the lowbrowed. Where are they gone? The hulking draymen and low-browed prize fighters, the brawny sailors with their buttocks bursting out of their white trousers, and the great overblown beauties with their swelling bosoms like the figureheads of Nelson's ships. What had these people in common with the gentle-mannered, undemonstrative, law-abiding English of today? Do such things as national cultures really exist? This is one of those questions, like the freedom of the will or the identity of the individual, in which all the arguments are on one side and instinctive knowledge is on the other. It is not easy to discover the connecting thread that runs through English life from the 16th century onwards, but all English people who bother about such subjects feel that it exists. They feel that they understand the institutions that have come to them out of the past. Parliament, for example, or Sabbatarianism, or the subtle grading of the class system, with an inherited knowledge impossible to a foreigner. Individuals, too, are felt to conform to a national pattern. D.H. Lawrence is felt to be very English, but so is William Blake. Dr. Johnson and G.K. Chesterton are somehow the same kind of person. The belief that we resemble our ancestors, that Shakespeare, say, is more like a modern Englishman than a modern Frenchman or German, may be unreasonable, but by existing, it influences conduct. Myths which are believed in tend to become true because they set up a type or persona which the average person will do his best to resemble. During the bad period of 1940, it became clear that in Britain, national solidarity is stronger than class antagonism. If it were really true that the proletariat has no country, 1940 was the time for him to show it. It was exactly then, however, that class feeling slipped into the background, only reappearing when the immediate danger had passed. Moreover, it is probable that the stolid behaviour of the British town populations under the bombing was partly due to the existence of the national persona, that is, to their preconceived idea of themselves. Traditionally, the Englishman is phlegmatic, unimaginative, not easily rattled, and since that is what he thinks he ought to be, that is what he tends to become. I'll just pause there, that Orwell has this wonderful matter-of-fact way of writing, which I've always admired, and it's particularly coming to the fore in this passage. And anyway, I'll try to keep my comments to a minimum, but I wanted to point that out. Dislike of hysteria and fuss, admiration for stubbornness, are all but universal in England, being shared by everyone except the intelligentsia. Millions of English people willingly accept as their national emblem the bulldog, an animal noted for its obstinacy, ugliness, and impenetrable stupidity. They have a remarkable readiness to admit that foreigners are more quote-unquote clever than themselves, and yet they feel that it would be an outrage against the laws of God and nature for England to be ruled by foreigners. Our imaginary observer would notice, perhaps, that Wordsworth's sonnets during the Napoleonic War might almost have been written during this one. He would know already that England has produced poets and scientists rather than philosophers, theologians, or pure theorists of any description, and might end by deciding that a profound, almost unconscious patriotism and an inability to think logically are the abiding features of the English character, traceable in English literature from Shakespeare onwards. The moral outlook of the English people. For perhaps 150 years, organised religion or conscious religious belief of any kind have had very little hold on the mass of the English people. Only about 10% of them ever go near a place of worship, except to be married and buried. A vague theism and an intermittent belief in life after death are probably fairly widespread, but the main Christian doctrines have largely been forgotten. Asked what he meant by Christianity, the average man would define it wholly in ethical terms. Unselfishness or loving your neighbour would be the kind of definition he would give. This was probably much the same in the early days of the Industrial Revolution, when the old village life had been suddenly broken up and the established church had lost touch with its followers. But in recent times, the nonconformist sects have also lost much of their vigour. And within the last generation, the Bible reading, which used to be traditional in England, has lapsed. It is quite common now to meet with young people who do not know the Bible stories, even as stories. But there is one sense in which the English common people have remained more Christian than the upper classes, and probably than any other European nation. This is in their non-acceptance of the modern cult of power worship. While almost ignoring the spoken doctrines of the church, they have held on to the one that the church never formulated because taking it for granted, namely that might is not right. It is here that the gulf between the intelligentsia and the common people is widest. From Carlyle onwards, but especially in the last generation, the British intelligentsia have tended to take their ideas from Europe and have been infected by the habits of thought that derive ultimately from Machiavelli. All the cults that have been fashionable in the last dozen years, communism, fascism, and pacifism, are in the last analysis forms of power worship. It is significant that in this country, unlike most others, the Marxist vision of socialism has found its warmest adherents in the middle class. Its methods, if not its theories, obviously conflict with what is called bourgeois morality, that is, common decency. And in moral matters, it is proletarians who are bourgeois. One of the basic folk tales of the English-speaking peoples is Jack the Giant Killer, the little man against the big man. Mickey Mouse, Popeye the Sailor, and Charlie Chaplin are all essentially the same figure. Chaplin's films, it is worth noticing, were banned in Germany as soon as Hitler came to power, and Chaplin has been viciously attacked by English fascist writers. Not merely a hatred of bullying, but a tendency to support the weaker side, merely because it is weaker, are almost general in England. Hence the admiration for a good loser and the easy forgiveness of failures either in sport, politics or war. Even in very serious matters, the English people do not feel that an unsuccessful action is necessarily futile. For example, in the 1939 to 1945 war was the campaign in Greece. No one expected it to succeed, but nearly everyone thought that it should be undertaken. And the popular attitude to foreign politics is nearly always coloured by the instinct to side with the underdog. An obvious recent instance was pro-Finnish sentiment in the Russo-Finnish War of 1940. This was genuine enough, as several by-elections fought mainly on this issue showed. Popular feeling towards the USSR had been increasingly friendly for some time past, but Finland was a small country attacked by a big one, and that settled the issue for most people. In the American Civil War, the British working class sided with the North, the side that stood for the abolition of slavery, in spite of the fact that the Northern blockade of the cotton ports was causing great hardship in Britain. In the Franco-Prussian War, such pro-French sentiment as there was in England was among the working class. The small nationalities oppressed by the Turks found their sympathisers in the Liberal Party, at that time the party of the working class and the lower middle class. And insofar as it bothered with such issues at all, British match sentiment was for the Abyssinians against the Italians, for the Chinese against the Japanese, and for the Spanish Republicans against Franco. It was also friendly to Germany during the period when Germany was weak and disarmed, and it is not surprising to see a similar swing of sentiment after this war. The feeling that one always ought to side with the weaker party probably derives from the balance of power policy which Britain had followed has followed from the 18th century onwards. A European critic would add that it is humbug, pointing in proof to the fact that Britain herself holds down subject populations in India and elsewhere. We don't, in fact, know what settlement the English common people would make with India if the decision were theirs. All political parties and all newspapers of whatever colour have conspired to prevent them from seeing the issue clearly. We do not know, however, that they have sometimes championed the weak against the strong when it was obviously not to their advantage. The best example is the Irish Civil War. The real weapon of the Irish rebels was British public opinion, which was substantially on their side and prevented the British government from crushing the rebellion in the only way possible. Even in the Boer War, there was a considerable volume of pro-Boer sentiment, though it was not strong enough to influence events. One must conclude that in this matter, the English common people have lagged behind their century. They have failed to catch up with power politics, realism, sacro-egoism, and the doctrine that the end justifies the means. The general English hatred of bullying and terrorism means that any kind of violent criminal gets very little sympathy. Gangsterism on American lines could not flourish in England, and it is significant that the American gangsters have never tried to transfer their activities to this country. At need, the whole nation would combine against people who kidnap babies and fire machine guns in the street. But even the efficiency of the English public force really depends on the fact that the police have public opinion behind them. The bad side of this is the almost universal toleration of cruel and out-of-date punishments. It is not a thing to be proud of that England should still tolerate such punishments as flogging. It continues partly because of the widespread psychological ignorance, partly because men are only flogged for crimes that forfeit nearly everyone's sympathy. There would be an outcry if it were applied to non-violent crimes or reinstituted for military offences. Military punishments are not taken for granted in England, as they are in most countries. Public opinion is almost certainly opposed to the death penalty for cowardice and desertion, though there is no strong feeling against hanging murderers. In general, the English attitude to crime is ignorant and old-fashioned, and humane treatment, even of child offenders, is a recent thing. Still, if Al Capone were in an English jail, it would not be for evasion of income tax. A more complex question than the English attitude to crime and violence is the survival of Puritanism and the world-famed English hypocrisy. The English people proper, the working masses who make up 75% of the population, are not puritanical. The dismal theology of Calvinism never popularized itself in England as it did for a while in Wales and Scotland. But Puritanism, in the looser sense in which the word is generally used, that is, prudishness, aestheticism, the killjoy spirit, is something that has been unsuccessfully forced upon the working class by the class of small traders and manufacturers immediately above them. In its origin, it had a clear, though unconscious, economic motive behind it. If you could persuade the working man that every kind of recreation was sinful, you could get more work out of him for less money. In the early 19th century, there was even a school of thought which maintained that the working man ought not to marry. But it would be unfair to suggest that the Puritan moral code was mere humbug. Its exaggerated fear of sexual immorality, which extended to a disapproval of stage plays, dancing, and even bright coloured clothes, was partly a protest against the real corruption of the later Middle Ages, and was also the new factor of syphilis, which appeared in England about the 16th century and worked frightful havoc for the next century or two. A little later, there was another new factor in the introduction of distilled liquors, gin, brandy, and so forth, which was very much more intoxicating than the beer and mead which the English had been accustomed to. The temperance movement was a well-meant reaction against the frightful drunkenness of the 19th century, product of slum conditions and cheap gin. It was necessarily led by fanatics who regarded not merely drunkenness, but even the moderate drinking of alcohol as sinful. During the past 50 years or so, there has even been a similar drive against tobacco. 100 years ago, or 200 years ago, tobacco smoking was much disapproved of, but only on the ground that it was dirty, vulgar, and injurious to health. The idea that it is a wicked self-indulgence is modern. This line of thought has never really appealed to the English masses. At most, they have been sufficiently intimidated by middle-class Puritanism to take some of their pleasures rather furtively. It is universally agreed that the working classes are far more moral than the upper classes, but the idea that sexuality is wicked in itself has no popular basis. Music hall jokes, Blackpool postcards, and the songs of the soldiers make up, and the songs that the soldiers make up are anything but puritanical. On the other hand, almost no one in England approves of prostitution. There are several big towns where prostitution is extremely blatant, but it is completely unattractive and has never really been tolerated. It could not be regulated and humanized as it has been in some other countries, because every English person feels in his bones that it is wrong. As the general weakening of sex morals that has happened during the past 20 or 30 years, it is probably a temporary thing, resulting from the excess of women over men in the population. In the matter of drink, the only result of a century of temperance agitation has been a slight increase in hypocrisy. The practical disappearance of drunkenness as an English vice has not been due to the anti-drink fanatics, but to competing amusements, education, the improvement in industrial conditions, and the expensiveness of drink itself. The fanatics have been able to see to it that the Englishman drinks his glass of beer under difficulties and with a faint feeling of wrongdoing, but have not actually been able to prevent him from drinking it. The pub, one of the basic institutions of English life, carries on in spite of the harassing tactics of the nonconformist local authorities. So also with gambling. Most forms of gambling are illegal according to the letter of the law, but they all happen on an enormous scale. The motto of the English people might be the chorus of Mary Lloyd's song, "A little of what you fancy does you good. A little of what you fancy does you good." They are not vicious, not even lazy, but they will have their bit of fun, whatever the higher-ups may say. And they may seem to be gradually winning their battle against the killjoy minorities. Even the horrors of the English Sunday have been much mitigated during the past dozen years. Some of the laws regulating pubs, designed in every case to discourage the publican and making drinking unattractive, were relaxed during the war. And it is a very good sign that the stupid rule forbidding children to enter pubs, which tended to dehumanise the pub and turn it into a mere drinking shop, is beginning to be disregarded in some parts of the country. Traditionally, the Englishman's home is his castle. In an age of conscription and identity cards, this cannot really be true. But the hatred of regimentation, the feeling that your spare time is your own, and that a man must not be persecuted for his opinions, is deeply ingrained, and the centralising processes, inevitable in wartime and still enforced, have not destroyed it. It is in fact that the much boasted freedom of the press is theoretical rather than actual. To begin with, the centralised ownership of the press means in practice that unpopular opinions can only be printed in books or in newspapers with small circulations. Moreover, the English people as a whole are not sufficiently interested in the printed word to be very vigilant about this aspect of their liberties. And during the last 20 years, there has been much tampering with the freedom of the press, with no real popular protest. Even the demonstrations against the suppression of the Daily Worker were probably stage managed by a small minority. On the other hand, freedom of speech is a reality, and a respect for it is almost general. Extremely few English people are afraid to utter their political opinions in public, and there are not even very many who want to silence the opinions of others. Some things change, eh, George? In peacetime, when unemployment can be used as a weapon, there is a certain amount of petty persecution of Reds. But the real totalitarian atmosphere, in which the state endeavours to control people's thoughts as well as their words, is hardly imaginable. The safeguard against it is partly the respect for integrity of conscience and the willingness to hear both sides, which can be observed at any public meeting. But it is also partly the prevailing lack of intellectuality. The English are not sufficiently interested in intellectual matters to be intolerant about them. Deviations and dangerous thoughts do not seem very important to them. An ordinary Englishman, conservative, socialist, Catholic, communist, or whatnot, almost never grasps the full logical implications of the creed he professes. Almost always he utters heresies without noticing it. Orthodoxies, whether of the right or the left, flourish chiefly among the literary intelligentsia, the people who ought, in theory, to be the guardians of freedom of thought. The English people are not good haters. Their memory is very short. Their patriotism is largely unconscious. They have no love for military glory, not much admiration for great men. They have the virtues and the vices of an old-fashioned people. To 20th century political theories, they oppose not a nether theory of their own, but a moral quality which must be vaguely described as decency. On the day in 1936 when the Germans reoccupied the Rhineland, I was in the northern mining town, I happened to go to a pub just after this piece of news, which quite obviously meant war had come over the wireless, and I remarked to others to the bar, the German army had crossed the Rhine. With a vague air of capping a quotation, somebody asked, parlez-vous? Somebody answered, parlez-vous? No more response than that. Nothing will ever wake these people up, I thought. But later in the evening at the same pub, someone sang a song which had recently come out with the chorus, for you can't do that there, eh. No, you can't do that there, eh. Anywhere else you can do that there, but you can't do that ear, I think it is. You can't do that ear. And it struck me that perhaps this was the English answer to fascism. At any rate, it is true that it has not happened here, in spite of fairly favourable circumstances. The amount of liberty, intellectual or other, that we enjoy in England ought not to be exaggerated, but the fact that it did not markedly diminish in nearly 60 years of desperate war is a hopeful symptom. All right, well, I mean, this goes on. Shall I do another bit? So he talks about the political outlook, looks at some pubs. Kind of an interesting book, I think. Look, he talks about the class system. Now, obviously, he's writing during World War II, so there's a lot of stuff about, you know, there's lots of references to the Germans all the way through this. So there are some miners, look. Just thought it'd be interesting to read a little bit of this. But I think I'm going to kind of stop there. I'm not going to read it all. One thing that's, I think, obvious to everybody listening to this is that the England that Orwell was describing in the 40s is, you know, coming to be something of a memory, you know, doesn't necessarily resemble, you know, some of the elements that he's talking about are still there, but many of them have been subverted, bastardized, diminished, and diluted, frankly, with an influx of foreign peoples who do not share those basic tendencies. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed this. I will be back next week, next Monday, for Cigar Stream. So long for now.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily...